Speak session number 10420, rule 53.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 53. What condition were the men in at this time?
Well, they were getting tired, and I think the strain was beginning to show to a certain degree on this very close fighting with the enemy in this much more enclosed country, as it were, than the Western Desert. They were fighting not at arm's length, but they were fighting almost chest to chest all the way across. And too, malaria had begun to show itself and became a very serious setback to some of the battalions. I believe the 5th East Yorks were almost decimated by their chaps being laid low with malaria. I certainly had some casualties, malarial casualties. Major Reggie Atkinson, he got it, and he had to go back. They all recovered in the end, but it was a nuisance, really.
Had you to take precautions?
Well, we had this mepocrine, and also the ointment which we had to put on, and we were supposed to sleep under mosquito nets, but then how can you sleep under a mosquito net when you're only 300 yards from the Germans? But I think really what was causing more trouble than anything else was the fact that the chaps were not getting proper rest. They were at it the whole time, on the go the whole time, and they never knew whether there'd be a German round the corner to knock them out.
Did it show itself in any way this
time?
Oh,
yes, I'm sure it did. It certainly did with me. I mean, I make no bones about it. I was beginning to get pretty tired and pretty tetchy, but we had to go on. And eventually we came to the outskirts of Catania, and we were in ditches there in close proximity to the enemy, and we got into some ditches, as I say, just outside Catania. I think it would be about the 4th of August, and the 8th Battalion were coming up between us and the coast, and the 7th Greenhards were coming up on our left across, but were having considerable difficulty getting across the Catania aerodrome. And you will see now we were at the bottom of Mount Etna, and Catania was on the seashore at the very foot of Mount Etna. But I remember we were in some shallow ditches there outside Catania, and in the middle of the day, and suddenly there was an awful burst of enemy firing, and I couldn't think what it was. And as I say, we were very, very close to them, and they were in ditches and in the thick orchards. And I looked up out of the ditch, and I looked back behind me, and there was an airman pushing a bicycle. And when he was fired at, he dropped his bicycle and dropped into the ditch. And I said, "What the hell are you doing?" "Oh, sir," he said, "would it be all right if I spend a few days leave with you?" I said, "Yes, but for God's sake, get in and keep quiet. Sit down there." Well, he followed us. I don't know how he followed us for 24 hours or so. What happened to him, I don't know. I really don't know what happened to his bicycle. But it staggered me that anybody would want to come and spend a few days leaving the front line. Anyhow, the next morning, on the 5th of August, the birds had flown, and we entered Catania, the city of Catania. The 9th DLI on the right, down by the coast, and we slightly higher on the very, very low slopes of Mount Etna. And we crept in very quietly in the morning, in case there were any snipers in Catania itself, we never knew, in case there were any mines had been laid, or booby traps laid too, and Reggie Atkinson's company and Spike Galloway's company, they entered first. And all was absolutely still. It was dawn, just early dawn, and it was really a glorious morning, and there was nobody about. Then the 9th Battalion were lower down in the main entrance, main part of this city, and then if by magic hundreds of poor inhabitants formed out of the cellars and the little houses to give us a royal welcome. They swarmed out all over the place. Flowers were thrown into the carriers, nuts were handed to us, and they were terribly poor. When I stopped in the more or less in the centre of the town, up came reporters and war correspondents writing on the steps of what they called the tribunal. Then came the filmmakers, but the companies kept on going, and they went forward. I did in fact come back to bring up battalion headquarters and the reserve company, and I found an absolute orgy of looting going on by the inhabitants. Of any shop that had been pro-German, they were swarming up there to the windows, up downcomers. They were smashing the windows. There was an absolute orgy of looting, and so much so that a battalion of Royal Marines were behind us, and they had to come in and restore order. And of course, the Sicilian police, the Italian police, had to be allowed to continue their normal duties. Anyhow, we cleared the city, and then we found stiff opposition as soon as we got out the far side into very, very rough country. There were sort of steep valleys coming down off Mount Etna, and these were very rough. We went down the road, steep banks, and then up the other side, and there was outside Mount Etna, very soon we came across, as I say, we came across a blown bridge, and that held up our advance. The birds, indeed, had not flown very far, and our advance was held up. Now, we had a disaster there, and I think I better just read you the report that was written at the time. We had received a warning that the bridges had been blown and the roads might have been severely mined. And I sent Pringle Bobby Pringle ahead, and some make sure that the road was clear. The a bridge had been blown, and I wrote this report, and I kept a copy of it at the time, and it was a report on the action of my carriers and some sappers of the field 505 field company on the morning of the 6th of August. As I say, the birds had not flown. On the morning of the 6th of August, orders were given to Captain Pringle to proceed with a carrier patrol from the outskirts of Catania, where the battalion was, to San Gregorio, with a view to ascertaining whether the enemy had withdrawn and whether the road was free from craters and mines. It was believed, in fact, that the road was cratered and mined, and in consequence, a party of sappers was sent to make the necessary recce and clearance to permit the advance of the battalion. Orders were given to this effect to the Royal Engineer officer, and the composition of the Royal Engineer party was left in his hands. The force moved off as follows. Three carriers headed by Captain Pringle with two sappers. One white scout car with Lieutenant Cussons, who was the sapper officer, and six sappers, and three carriers, each carrying two sappers. The vehicles moved up the road at 50. And it gives you this, gives you a typical example of what battle was like fighting these rear guards. When the head of the column reached the road junction at 974855, an anti-tank gun was fired by the enemy from a certain area, and the shot hit the wall by the scout car. Captain Pringle gave the order to withdraw and turned his carrier into the track on the right. The carrier immediately behind his turned round and went back, warning those he passed. But the anti-tank hit the scout car, and Lieutenant Cussons was seen to be wounded. The third carrier was hit slightly, and the engine stopped. The crew jumped on the second carrier as it passed, but the NCO remained in an endeavour to get it started. The rear section of carriers and the carrier behind Captain Pringle managed to withdraw safely. After about 5 minutes, Captain Pringle brought his carrier out of the turning and back down the road to cover round the left-hand bend. He was under heavy spando and anti-tank fire all the way, but observed the trouble with his third carrier and scout car. On arriving in safety round the bend, he and his crew got out of his carrier to see if they had been hit, and he said he would walk up to the scout car and see if he could do anything for the wounded sapper officer. About 10 yards in front of him, and in the opposite side of the road, was an entrance drive to a house. And when he came level with it, he was ordered to put up his hands by a voice in German. His gunner, who was standing in front of the carrier, heard this and saw him walk towards the entrance with his hands up, and heard him say, "Okay, lads, we've had it." As the gunner could still not see anyone, he made a dash for it and got away. The remainder of the personnel on this carrier were taken prisoners. So it shows you, we lost Captain Pringle and two other ranks as prisoners of war. We lost one other rank wounded and brought back. The NCO of the third carrier, who dashed away and got into hiding somewhere, came back in the early evening, and we lost two carriers. But the sappers lost Cousins, who was wounded and missing, one other rank killed, one other wounded and missing, three other ranks missing, a white scarf full of equipment and various wireless sets, Ben guns, revolvers, binoculars, prismatic compasses, pick shovels and hammers. So that gives you, that little disaster happened to us after we'd left Catania and were trying to head our way northwards again, over this very, very rough ground. The bridge, in fact, in front of us was blown, but the sappers always could make diversions, generally, when the bridge was blown. And it wasn't long before a diversion was made. But it was a nasty incident when you lose a really good officer like Bobby Pringle was. Anyhow, we were then brought into reserve at Tricaretse, I think the place was called. The front was narrowing very much now because the slopes of Mount Etna forced it to narrow. And we came into there. And the inhabitants of that particular town gave the leading company a written address of welcome, warning us where the Germans were. And they were really rather good, the inhabitants, because at night, from now onwards, some of them came back and told us where the Germans were, managed to get through the lines and come and tell us where they were. And it was about now, I think, I remember, though, there's a typical example of this unpleasant fighting. Well, the 8th Battalion were in front, we were behind, and I remember coming round a corner and finding a whole section of the 8th Battalion all lying shot dead. They'd been caught unawares as they came round the corner. It was this sort of... you never knew what happened, you never knew what was ahead, never knew what might happen to you, that was getting everybody slightly down. Anyhow, we went into reserve around about the 7th of August, and there was a very comfortable villa by the roadside, and I managed to get into this villa. I think we were eventually let in by the caretaker. We found 6 bottles of Munich beer on the sideboard in the dining room, so we made short shift with them. And I slept actually under the veranda of the house in my pyjamas. I thought, but damn, this is so comfortable and luxurious. And I slept there. I wouldn't sleep inside the house because I just couldn't bear sleeping inside the house, having slept outside for so long. And there was a most wonderful view from the end of the garden of this villa, looking down right out to the Mediterranean and the olive trees and fruit trees. It was really a superb view. And I did, in fact, have a cold bath in the bath of the house. There was an extraordinary sort of, in the garden, a culvert which human beings could get into. And there were hidden in that culvert an enormous number of Sicilians. And they all came out when they realized we were there. And there was one delightful old man, aristocratic old chap, whose daughter was there, and her husband. And they, I think, had a large house in Gregorio, San Gregorio. Anyhow, she was over the moon at meeting the British. And next day she sent a bottle of scent down for the adjutant's wife. I think she went back up to Gregorio to her house, but I will remember the joy at which those people came out of that culvert on their hands and knees almost to be free once more, and especially this very aristocratic woman who sent the scent to the adjutant. Now the 8th and 9th Battalion were ahead us, and they found some pretty stiff opposition in the town of Acharale, which was a coastal town. And we started to move up to get to St. Filippo. And we found there for that particular night a very lovely irrigation ditch with water flowing through it, beautiful cold water, and I remember I dipped my head in it, I was getting so hot. But there were a lot of these irrigation ditches which had water in and were flowing through the fruit groves. And there were particularly, this part of the island, a lot of lemons. Lemon trees were particularly prolific there. And then on the 9th of August, we're getting now, we moved up at dusk behind the 19th, behind the 9th battalion, ready to move through to continue the advance. Now, there were many, many demolitions in Acharale, but we moved up along the coast road and we got a terrific welcome in Acharale. Perhaps the inhabitants gave the same to the Germans when they arrived, but to us they seemed delighted to see us. And as I say, they told us, gave us useful information as to where the Germans were hiding and where they were likely to be provide opposition to us as we moved along the road. Incidentally, they all didn't want to be have anything to do with Mussolini or Italy again, and they wanted to become a British colony. But it was really rather an interesting town, Acharale, because it was a coastal town and it had a little tiny shipyard. And I did, when I went back there, I think, to look around it. There were five funny wooden ships on the stocks. Anyhow, by the 10th, B and C companies were offered first light and they made some very good progress, but found another bridge, yet another bridge, blown. And we had to spend the nightfall, at nightfall, the battalion headquarters in a lane leading down to a little village called Pregiola. Now, that day, Private Worthington, who was the batman of a company commander called commanding, I forget now which company, D Company, I think, Dick Bousfield, was visiting his platoons, and Worthington carried out a very gallant exploit indeed. He went into the village of Altarella and on his own, when his company commander was looking at his platoons, and he saw standing outside a house a German sentry, and he pretended to be an Italian, and the sentry, he acted like an Italian and he said he was an Italian, and he was shown various positions in the village and outside the village. But then an officer arrived, a German officer arrived, and Worthington shot them both, the sentry and the officer. And he returned home, and he went up to the regiment, Royal Artillery OP, and pointed out all the positions that he'd been shown by the sentry, which were heavily shelled. And next morning, patrols found the birds had flown. Nevertheless, they lobbed in a few grenades to where the sentry had been standing. And for that, Worthington did get an award, an immediate award.
Could he speak Italian?
No, but he acted like an Italian. Oh, no, he couldn't speak an Italian. He might have been able to pick up a few Italian words. Nearly all our chaps could soon make themselves understood in whatever language, whichever country they were in. Now, despite a certain amount of opposition, we pushed on to Riposto, and the next day we were in contact with the enemy beyond Riposto on the edge of a dried river, and we then pushed on still further, and we entered Riposto, and that was the end of the operations in Sicily. We faded out of all operations thereafter. One of the things that I noticed too when we were in that area of Riposto was HMS George V. It was a big battleship, and it had sailed up the coast as we were moving up. And we had a naval officer from time to time with us who could wireless to the battleship and call for very heavy enemy fire. But their fire was so terrific that it blasted everything to pieces going up to Messina below Taormina along the coast. It was carved out of great cliffside, and the HMS George V thought they'd shell some vehicles, I think, moving along the road, German vehicles retreating along the road. They blew the road to absolute smithereens, and nobody else could get along it. So the sappers had sort of spent hours and days repairing it. So the Navy was told to pipe down a bit and don't do such damage. We'd call for their fire just before Primosole, I think, before we attacked at the Primosole Bridge, I think we'd call for their fire. But it was so heavy and so appalling that the damage done, I don't know what guns they were, 6-inch or what, some huge things, that they were asked not to continue with their operations.